Good afternoon, and welcome to Coastal Conversations from the University of Maine Sea Grant Program. I'm Galen Koch, host and producer of Island Institute's podcast, From the Sea Up. Today, we're featuring an episode of From the Sea Up's third season. We're learning how some individuals and businesses in Maine's fishing industry are coming up with innovative solutions to reduce plastic in the ocean by creating plastic-free ocean gear. You're listening to From the Sea Up, a podcast from Island Institute. I'm Galen Koch.
Plastic gear, non-plastic gear.
On a snowy day in late February 2024, I traveled to Stonington, Maine with photographer Nicole Wolf.
Cedar?
Yep. All right, first things first, introduce yourselves. Mm-hmm. Name, who you are, where we are. Ben, you can go first if you want.
Ben Jackson in Stonington, Maine.
What do you
make into a sentence?
Brevity. Okay. My name is Ben Jackson. I work at Deer Isle Oyster Company in Stonington, Maine.
I'm Abby Barrows. I am the owner operator of Deer Isle Oyster Company.
Great. Do you do any? Do you have any other things that you two do?
No, nothing at all. I'm a research scientist focused on microplastic pollution in aquatic systems, and I'm a research associate with College of the Atlantic.
I wear a bunch of hats. I have a little fabrication shop, do some woodworking. I'm an EMT on our local ambulance. I'm on the board of the library.
You building your own house?
We're building our house.
Parents to a little five-year-old.
I grew up in Stonington, and I've known Abby for a very long time. Like me, she was born and raised here.
We're married.
We're romantically involved.
Attached.
And now financially attached.
There's no going back now, cleanly. Yeah, we've been together for more than 20 years.
Wow.
Yep.
We have a dog together.
And a daughter.
Abby met Ben, who lived in nearby Orland, in high school. Together, they went abroad for college to the University of Tasmania in Australia, about as far away from a Maine island as you could get. And it was there that Abby started learning about Maine's fisheries in marine education classes.
I think that was the first time thinking about fisheries and having an interest in fisheries after I had left this community. So that kind of got in my brain.
Abby and Ben moved back to Stonington in their mid-20s. They both hopped on the back of lobster boats and began to think seriously about how to make a life together in this rural Downies town that just happens to be Maine's highest grossing lobster port.
I started to recognize how much the wild fisheries were changing and how the Gulf of Maine was changing and how that was going to impact the community. I also had begun work at what is now the Shaw Institute, doing water quality monitoring.
The Shaw Institute is a scientific research organization based in Blue Hill, Maine. The institute focuses on environmental health. Abby worked there as a marine researcher and educator after college.
And as those things sort of came together, learning more about water quality and water clarity and the importance of healthy aquatic systems, and then coupling that with my growing knowledge and appreciation of Stonington as this working waterfront community and seeing the inevitable changes that were coming down the pipeline, I started to hear more about oysters. I'd never grown up eating them, had no sort of background in oysters or aquaculture at all. And I just kept on, you know, at conferences, listening in on things and just slowly learning more about it and being like, wow, this is amazing fishery. Super sustainable. It hits all those environmental aspects that I'm really interested in terms of water clarity and water quality, how they are ecosystem engineers, that they're native species. And it seemed more and more that this was a great fisheries to have supplement and support our existing wild caught fisheries. I was running an education program for teenagers at the Shaw Institute, a summer program. It was a two-week course, and I was trying to get all these different people to come in and talk to the kids so I didn't have to talk for 2 weeks.
The summer program brought Abby in contact with Ginny Olson, chair of the Shellfish Committee and a partial owner of an oyster farm with her husband, Blaine.
And so after she's come in and spoken to my students, I reached back out to her. It's probably end of August, early September. I'm like, man, let's get oysters. And so I called her, left a message, didn't hear back for weeks. She finally called back. She said, sorry, Abby, we don't have any oysters for sale, but do you want to buy the oyster farm? At that point, my scientific research was really ramping up.
Abby had been conducting microplastics research since 2012, work that had her analyzing the distribution of microplastics in water samples from all over the world as part of the Global Microplastics Initiative with Adventure Scientists.
I had opened up a lab, I had employees, I was spending a ton of time staring down a microscope and on my computer doing data. Which I loved on many levels, but it was also killing me to be sitting down year-round. And I was really missing that on-the-water time. And I saw this as like an opportunity to sort of have this little side hustle that would allow me to be my own boss and to be out in the water and be challenged in a different way. So after I decided, I'm like, oh yeah, I do want to buy the oyster farm. I was like, wait a second, I have zero business background. I have zero credit because I haven't been living in this country. I don't know the first thing about business or growing oysters, but how hard can it be? And we were totally broke. We didn't have any money. I'm like, what? Can I put my bicycle up as collateral damage? I don't like.
Yeah, I remember I tried to put my guitar up, and they're like, that's not a thing. Yeah. We don't do that. Like, but that's the most expensive thing I have.
As a woman business owner, Abby was able to scrape together loans from the Farm Service Agency, the USDA, and she got an aquaculture loan from Farm Credit East. In 2015, she bought the farm from Ginny Olson and her husband, Blaine. But there was one thing she hadn't anticipated.
When I purchased the farm, the gear came with it. We shifted it all over here onto our land. And that was like the first stab in the heart. I was in the midst of doing all this global microplastics research and learning more and more about how much plastic is in all of our aquatic systems from, you know, at that point I was analyzing samples from alpine lakes in remote areas and like, you know, headwaters of rivers in northern Canada. I was finding plastic in all of this. And it's like, oh my God, this is a global crisis. And when I purchased the farm and the gear, it was just like truckload after truckload of plastic oyster gear. I'm like, oh my God, this is killing me. It was pretty painful. And immediately I was like, how can I change this? But, you know, I was brand new to business, totally bootstrapped. And I'm like, I'm going to use this, but how can I change this? And that was like definitely the beginning of thinking about how we could re-envision the future of aquaculture, not using plastic to grow food.
And so Abby and Ben set out to try to change the amount of plastic on their oyster farm. Along with other innovators like Katie Weiler at Viable Gear in Portland, Maine, they're coming up with plastic-free solutions for fisheries and sea farms. In this episode, we'll learn how Deer Isle Oyster Company and Viable Gear are forging ahead with innovations and research to try to reduce plastic in the ocean. These individuals and businesses demonstrate how much effort goes into innovation and how even the smallest change can have a huge impact on the sustainability of our fisheries. But that plastic gear comes at a cost. As Abby's microplastics research proves, these plastic products don't go away. They never truly break down. They become microscopic pieces that float in our waterways, get into our food, into the soil in which we grow our food, and into our bodies.
Every time I went out there and was handling plastic gear and, you know, using zip ties and being like, oh my gosh, this just like does not jive with everything else I'm trying to do in my life. And also does not sit well with this data that is now being churned out from the project I'm doing all over the world, just like plastic. There's so much plastic in our environment. And I'm like, okay, how can we shift this? So in 2020, I co-wrote a grant with Smithereen Farm, the Greenhorns, to get some seed money to start testing out alternative materials. So they really were the principal investigators on that. And I was the commercial farm that was going to test, but I had my hands pretty deeply in with the design.
With the help of that grant and Smithereen Farm in Pembroke, Abby began to seriously tackle the problem of plastic gear on her oyster farm. She found in her research that, remarkably, there was no model anywhere for a completely plastic-free farm.
I would love if someone else had been tackling this for 20 years and trialing things out. I mean, back in 2020, when we first got our first funding to start looking into alternative materials for growing oysters, I did sort of this international historical search. Like, what are people using? What are people using in Southeast Asia, where they've been, farming in the ocean for millennia? And yes, historically, there are some things like bamboo rafts and glass balls and things like that. But in the way that we cultivate oysters here in North America is pretty unique. And there isn't a long history of doing it in this way. And so therefore, a lot of this technique came on board when plastic came on board. And so it's rethinking about how we can have similar designs and cultivation techniques, but using different materials.
And for Abby and Ben, it was really important to try to create plastic-free alternative gear that made sense on a working oyster farm. They didn't want to reinvent the wheel.
Surface culture farms are really set up in two ways in terms of what gear they use. They either use like the oyster ranch, so like the flow and grow system, which is a 4 or 6 bay ranch, which is infrastructure that holds multiple bags. And so it's a way to have a lot of oysters in one area. And the other way is these single bags that have 2 floats on them. And so we sort of went back and how can we duplicate these exact designs but not use plastic, which is where we were, but we got a little off track a couple of years ago thinking about other ways to design things, and we realized we don't need to redesign the oyster bag, we need to redesign the materials.
Researching alternative materials prompted Abby to reach out to other innovators on the coast. Innovation doesn't happen in a vacuum, especially when that innovation requires lots of testing on and off of sea farms. This is where organizations like Island Institute can be especially helpful. Community organizations can help make connections between people like Abby and other researchers, vendors, and farmers. Through their research and through their networks, Abby and Ben met Katie Weiler, the founder of Viable Gear in Portland, Maine.
We are in the New England Ocean Cluster in Portland, Maine. My name is Katie Weiler. I am the founder and president of Viable Gear.
Like Abby, Katie's motivation to found Viable Gear was her determination to eliminate plastic waste in the environment. Katie grew up in Camden, Maine, and when living in Wyoming, watched a documentary called The Plastic Ocean. After the film, she pledged to be plastic-free for 30 days. In 2019, she moved back to Maine.
Then we had this fun little thing called the pandemic. And during that, I happened to have some more time to be up in the mid-coast and was out on an island called Brimstone. And there was a ton more plastic and really a lot of ghost gear on the island that day. And that was a really big impetus in me. I knew I wanted to pivot my career at that point, but that was really hey, I want to work on ghost gear. I want to figure out plastics entering the ocean.
Katie founded the company Viable Gear to develop and research plastic-free materials for fishing gear. For Katie, that task was as much about reducing plastic entering ecosystems as it was about the safety of our food and food systems. Plastic is the most abundant debris in the ocean. Every year, an estimated 11 million metric tons of plastic enters marine environments. Some of this plastic is what's known as ghost gear, fishing gear that is lost or left in the ocean.
A big piece of what Viable Gear's mission is to reduce toxic plastics in our blue food system or food system in general. So we really come at this from a public health side as well, which is not only are marine species being harmed from plastics, macroplastics and ghost gear, and then microplastics that break down from that ghost gear, but it gets into our food system as well. And it's just something that we don't really have a handle on exactly what it does right now, but there's definitely endocrine impacts. There's definitely cancer impacts. So yeah, there's just more to that piece of like why we really want to reduce plastics in the ocean.
You are listening to Coastal Conversations on WERU at 89.9 FM and streaming online at weru.org. Plastic contains chemicals that are hazardous to our health. You may have heard of PFAS, chemicals used in plastic manufacturing that have gained the term forever chemicals because they persist in the environment, our bodies, and even the water we drink for, well, forever. PFAS have been linked to reproductive and developmental issues and certain types of cancers, among other things. Reducing plastic in our ecosystems and food systems not only cuts back on plastic waste, but also on the prevalence of these forever chemicals in our waterways and in our bodies. But transitioning away from plastic and fishing gear is a daunting task. As I said before, plastic is everywhere. So Katie started with one small, applicable innovation in the kelp industry.
The seeding twine is an easy start because it's not this like big piece of gear that has crazy tensile strength and needs to have load for like a year. You know, it's in the water for like 4 or 5 months. It's in the hatchery for 3 to 4 weeks. So it was a really good place for us to start. That's like, what's a twine, like a micro rope that will help drive R&D.
Seeding twine is a very thin piece of rope that is embedded with kelp seed. Kelp farmers wind this twine onto the larger nylon rope that they suspend between buoys in the ocean. That seed will grow into the long kelp blades that are the harvestable crop. And when the crop is harvested, this twine gets stripped from the kelp lines, producing tiny bits of plastic from the discarded seeding twine. For Katie, this was a great product to start experimenting on because of the impacts of this plastic shedding and because the twine is so small and not load-bearing.
Making a lower tensile strength, like really good rope out of the blue is really hard, obviously. So then I was like, okay, small rope. That way we can build up to a bigger rope. And at this time, I was really into kelp and had read a book. I think it was Eat Like a Fish, Bren's book, that was like talking about the polysaccharide structure of kelp, essentially. And I was like, oh, well, the polysaccharide structure is really similar to corn, and people are making plastic out of corn. So somebody's got to be making plastic out of kelp or seaweed. Who's doing it? There was an article that, or like a scientific journal out of the University of Tel Aviv that they had made plastic out of seaweed. So I started reaching out to them and digging into it. And everyone was like, yeah, like we've done it lab scale, but we haven't, it's not commercialized. And I was like, well, people are doing it. So if nobody's actually doing it, then I might as well do it myself or give it a shot. But like you said, I don't have a science background. So I was like, who can I find? I do feel like networking and like that side of like building a business is kind of something I'm decent at. So I was like, all right, let's find someone who is a materials engineer. Turns out that's actually the hardest part, is that polymer engineers and material scientists are not a dime a dozen like mechanical engineers. You can kind of like turn in Maine and I feel like trip over a mechanical engineer, but not anyone who's more in the polymer side of things and biopolymers. So that was the biggest piece that I struggled with at first to really get off the ground.
Katie ended up working closely with Colin Hepburn at Everything Seaweed and students at USM's CERL, Composite Engineering Research Laboratory, to do materials research for Viable Gear's first product. And in the process, Katie learned to do her own materials research. She's now producing prototypes in her home lab.
It's wild. I think the first time we like extruded it, or I had seen it after it had been extruded in the lab by some of the students, actually, it was the original really basic formula. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like really feels like a nylon string. This is kind of exciting.
The nylon replacement that Katie makes feels almost exactly like plastic. It's a teal color, an ode to the kelp it's derived from. Viable Gear's plastic-free twine is made from brown macroalgae. Katie wanted to make sure the seaweed was a variety that could eventually be grown in the Gulf of Maine.
Right now, our material is 99.5% seaweed-based. So there has been some different like, oh, should we add some cellulose into it? And, you know, different things like that that other companies have done. And we play around with it and see where that lands us. And We've played around with putting some natural materials in it, like wool, and that could be exciting for us in terms of texture. What we've heard from the industry is that they don't want anything that feels like a natural kind of, like, going back to the, like, hemp lines of the past, because there's a lot around, like, oh, does it degrade faster? Does it not fish well on a rocky bottom once you get up to, like, larger gear? But that's a piece where we're really trying to make, you had noted, like, what does it feel like? Our material feels like plastic. Then people get our material in their hands and they're like, this is like, is really cool and feels like plastic and it's really strong. And you're like, yeah, see, I told you we could do it. So, or we are doing it.
Scaling products and creating affordable, reliable alternatives to plastics is a key part of innovating these materials in fisheries and marine industries. You can't just create a product and expect people to buy it because it's sustainable. It needs to be cost-effective, good for fishing, and good for the environment. Viable Gear's first product is seeding twine for the kelp industry, but Katie has her eyes on other fisheries, like the lobster fishery. Part of her research involves asking lobstermen and other fishers about their plastic use and generating ideas about what could be replaced.
I really appreciate how much support I've had in the fishing industry, where I thought, people are sometimes averse to change in that area, but it's actually not true. I think we've been hearing a lot more about those stories, which is like fishermen want change and want to be stewards of the ocean. And I've loved really seeing that everyone's like, what can we do to help? Or like, hey, this is the biggest thing, is like, if it costs more, I'm not going to buy it. So just FYI.
In addition to a nylon string replacement, Viable Gear is working with Everything Seaweed to create a plastic-free coating that could be used for other gear innovations.
We're basically working on a marine coating for companies who need a little bit more robust lifespan to something like the MycoBuoy. So uncoated, it lasts like a year in the marine environment.
A MycoBuoy is a buoy made of mycelium, fungi that can grow into any shape you want. The design was developed by Sue Van Hook, and the buoys are currently in the research and development phase. These buoys are a great plastic alternative, but figuring out how to make them last in the marine environment is a challenge. With Everything Seaweed, Katie developed a kelp-derived coating that could replace typical polyurethane sealant.
One of the MycoBuoys is actually in the water off of Abby's farm.
Okay.
Yeah, so she's testing that for us. And then I know Abby is trying to get a bunch more MycoBuoys deployed. I think she was saying in the spring. But if it does work as a coating, then probably we would just like send a bunch of it up for Abby to coat her buoys with.
Back in Stonington, we're visiting Abby and Ben's new shop, where they're making some of their alternative gear.
Sit in the water. You know, these float it. These are just some of the prototypes.
Mushroom.
These are prototypes that have never been in the water and buoys that have come in from the farm to be assessed.
I really like this design because they float really well and it's like Maine. It's like, what do we have? We have coastline and wood.
Innovation takes time, energy, and resources. For Abby and Ben of Deer Isle Oyster Company, that meant a lot of testing, experimentation, and sometimes failures. This work is not for the faint of heart.
So in 2020, we've got some of our first alternative gear out in the water in August, and it was mostly a complete disaster. I shouldn't frame it as a complete disaster. It was a serious learning curve. We lost a bunch of oysters and we just learned like, oh, this, this basalt mesh does not work, in this way. This mechanism for opening and getting oysters out of this bag does not work. It's just like, there's no way to scale this. So that all got me really jazzed up. Like, this is actually way harder than I thought. But I'm also like, this is a really intriguing challenge. Like, this should not be this hard to be able to grow food not in plastic. And so based on that first that first year, we actually got some great media coverage, and that put us on the radar of some other funders. And so they, the Builders Initiative asked me to apply for a grant with them, which we did, and that's when Ben really came on board.
With Ben Jackson, Abby's partner, at the helm of some materials experimentation, Deer Isle Oyster Company's research and development really ramped up. One of the most difficult aspects of this research is that it needs to be tested in the marine environment, on the farm itself. It can't be done in a tank somewhere. The materials need to experience what a season on the farm would be like, and if something doesn't work, the testing begins again next season.
I think that by the end of this coming season, we will have a product that really we could feel confident other people using on a commercial level. I think that, you know, one more season of having things in the environment, retooling things a little bit, making it a little more streamlined, a little more user-friendly, will allow us to produce something that really could be scalable and be sort of market-ready. And the hope is that we will produce this and we'll draw up plans and have that be open source. So anyone who wants to do that can do it on their own and potentially have a side business that people could place orders and we would build out that gear for them. But that's sort of a conversation we need to have next winter, and if that's something that we are interested in doing or if someone would step forward and want to do that.
Thanks for listening to From the Sea Up. This episode was produced by me, Galen Koch, and production assistant Olivia Jolly. Camden Hunt provided editorial help. Nicole Wolf takes the photographs that accompany this episode. Special thanks to Abby Barrows and Ben Jackson of Deer Isle Oyster Farm and Katie Weiler of Viable Gear. Most of the music in this episode is by Q Shop. You can hear more of their tunes at www.cue-shop.com. From the Sea Up is made possible by the Fund for Maine Islands through a partnership between Island Institute, College of the Atlantic, Maine Sea Grant, and the First Coast. To hear past episodes and for more information, visit www.islandinstitute.org/podcast.
Thank you to Galen Koch for providing this month's episode of Coastal Conversations. This is Keegan Klonch, student at College of the Atlantic and assistant producer for Coastal Conversations, here to sign us off. Join us on the fourth Friday of each month at 4 p.m. for information, stories, and conversations about the issues and people of the Maine coast. That great music you are hearing in the background is called A Following Sea and was composed and performed by Paul Anderson. On behalf of Maine Sea Grant and in partnership with the Skudik Institute and the First Coast, we wish you a good weekend.